Hello,
everybody, and welcome to the YYJ Halloween Market 2025 Early Bat Hour. That is my little sister, Sarah.
And that's my big sister, Jamie.
And we are the hosts of Ghoul Society, a spooky, creepy, historical, paranormal, true crime comedy podcast or something like that.
Yeah.
Today we are gathered on the traditional, unceded, stolen territories of the Songhees and Esquimalt First Nations and the Lekwungen and Wasanich peoples, whose historical relations with the land continue to this day. As uninvited guests on this land, we are committed to disrupting racism and colonial violence within ourselves, our families, and our communities. By listening to this podcast, you've officially been inducted into the Ghoul Society. Da-da-da-da.
Well, do I have a story for you guys today?
Okay, I'm excited.
Okay, Jamie already knows we had to tell each other because otherwise we probably would have done the same thing.
That's true.
But that's okay.
And we normally don't. We normally keep it as a surprise.
It's normally a surprise, but today it couldn't be. That's okay. Situated in the core of downtown Victoria, BC, the famed Bastion Square was once a place that you wouldn't want to be sent, but has over time become the pedestrian market area we know today. Rumored as one of the most haunted areas of the city, Bastion Square is located where Fort Victoria was constructed and stood on the traditional territories of the Songhees and Esquimalt Nations and the Wasanich and Lekwungen peoples who have and continue to live with the land. There's a lot of history regarding this area that spans thousands of years before colonization. The indigenous nations that have lived in the area were and are hunter-gatherers, with an emphasis on fishing for their communities. Hunting and fishing for the Lekwungen people is said to be considered sacred, as bounties were shared within the community, neighboring nations, and traded or sold to strangers. It's incredibly important to note the significance of the area of what is now downtown Victoria, as colonization caused the indigenous peoples of this land to be forcibly dispersed from areas that aided in their livelihoods. When colonizer James Douglas arrived on the shores of the Songhees and Esquimalt First Nations, the indigenous peoples actually shared their lives and culture with the settlers, but the settlers had their sights on ensuring the southern end of what is now Vancouver Island didn't get colonized by the Americans,
right,
who were quote-unquote expanding,
yeah,
their land,
yeah,
at the same time as settlers in Canada were on the east of the country.
Right.
The Lekwungen peoples aided in the settlers with Fort Victoria well into the 1850s when the famed Douglas Treaties were signed. And these treaties were made of orally agreed upon terms, stating that the nations of the area would hold claim to their land.
Mm-hmm.
But this was thwarted when they signed a blank piece of paper,
right,
and Douglas then wrote that they had given away their land.
Yeah, and also culturally, there was never an understanding that,
yes,
land was to be owned.
Right, yeah.
Like, they were like, oh, you're going to help us take care of the land, and,
great,
like, we'll share resources?
Yeah.
That's awesome. And,
yeah,
then it was like, actually, ownership.
Exactly. So, and yeah, and these treaties, quote unquote, have been disputed ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's far more information regarding the colonization of now Victoria, but this kind of sped up history gives you an idea of the tumultuous energy that Victoria and Bastion Square itself were built upon.
True.
So the buildings you see surrounding Bastion Square were built at the height of the Klondike Gold Rush up in northern Canada around the late 1800s to early 1900s.
Hmm.
A special note is the Provincial Courthouse, also known as the former Victoria Law Courts. And this building was built in 1889.
Is it also the jail? It was,
yeah,
the jail? Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm laughing because that's where we went actually for our most recent ghost tour led by Ghostly Walks. Shout out to Ghostly Walks. Yeah.
At its completion, the total cost was $35,000, which in today's money
is $1,050,000.
No. Way too high.
$85,000.
$100,000.
Okay. Okay, I was pretty close.
Yeah.
It was pretty close.
Yeah, so the courthouse remained a courthouse and the law courts until February of 1962, when it held its last hearing, and all proceedings moved to the new courthouse. And then in 2014, or well before 2014, but it used to be the Maritime Museum of BC.
Oh, before it moved.
But they moved in 2021.
Okay. Because I saw this thing where someone was like, the Maritime Museum is the spookiest place I ever stayed in. And then I like Google Maps it and I was like, really? But that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. And it's actually now empty.
Oh.
Yeah. Because it's not up to
code
earthquakes,
right.
I guess.
Yeah.
You know.
That makes sense.
And one of the most famous people to roam the halls of this courthouse is a friend of the pod, Matthew Bigby, who you might recall from our first episode. Sir, this is a cemetery.
Oh my, a friend of the pod.
Yeah.
That's the funniest thing you've ever said.
Judge Bigby would become known as the hanging judge, if you recall.
Yes.
As it said, he would sentence multiple people to death by hanging at the gallows, which were in the heart of Bastion Square.
Okay, I actually heard he wasn't actually that bad of a guy, and he's actually really progressive.
Yeah, we're going to get into it.
Oh, okay, great. I love that.
He was the first judge to rule in favor of an indigenous man over a white settler.
Yes.
Based on the testimony of the indigenous nation's people in 1860 when this white man assaulted an indigenous man.
Right.
He also had a very positive view of the indigenous peoples in the area.
Good.
And he thought that they had a more natural intelligence and honesty than most of the white people.
Snaps to that. I fully agree.
And it's said that he even made an effort to learn some indigenous words and languages.
Cool.
So, yeah, he was pretty cool.
He was cool. But how did he get the nickname?
Well, he was kind of racist.
Oh.
Against the Asian population in the city.
Oh, okay. So he wasn't actually that cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
And,
I see.
Yeah. And he, you know, had some outbursts in the courtroom. Like the time when he called the jury a, quote, pack of Dallas horse thieves, unquote, for convicting a murderer only of manslaughter. He was like, you idiots.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Contrary to popular belief, though, and according to a biographer who wrote on Bigby's life, he wasn't even considered a hanging judge during his time as a judge.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's said that he found it, quote, abhorrent to take human life.
Yeah.
End quote.
Cool.
Yeah, so he was with it.
I agree.
And yeah, like during some of his time as a judge between 1859 and 1872, there were 52 murder charges total. And in 18 of the 38 convicted trials, he remained neutral or even recommended a reduced sentence.
Interesting.
Rather than hanging.
Okay, interesting. Mm. But yet, he is known as...
Yes. So, the reason why he's known as the hanging judge, because he was the judge in the trial of what is known as the Chilcotin War.
Oh, yes. Okay.
In 1864, colonizers wanted a road to access the Caribou gold fields from Butte Inlet in northern BC.
Yeah.
Which ran through the Chilcotin territory.
Yeah.
And during this time, tensions were rising. There was a wave of smallpox that was killing the indigenous peoples in the area. And so the Chilcotin were pissed off that colonizers just expected to travel through their lands without any compensation.
Yeah.
They were like
permission or anything.
Well, they actually helped them build the road at first.
Mm.
But then they were like, you're not giving us anything.
Right. Like, why are we
for us allowing you to do this?
Yeah.
And so the Chilcotin declared a war to defend their people and their lands, rightfully so.
Yeah.
But they didn't mean it as murder. They were just like, we're going to defend our land.
Yeah.
And
OG land defenders.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, the governor and the colonizers were like, no. So they sent a militia in.
Okay.
And there was some killing and there was some fighting because there's land defense happening here,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then eventually a truce was brought up. They were like, let's figure this out. But guess what? It was a trick.
What?
The governor tricked them. So the governor tricked this nation.
Okay.
And there were five chiefs that were going to talk with the governor.
Yeah.
But the governor wasn't even there.
Oh.
And so they were shackled. And they were tried for murder.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah.
That's so crazy.
So how does Bigby fit into this? Well, he thought, he was like, it's awful to hang five indigenous chiefs at the same time.
Yeah.
But he did it anyway. That was his decision. He made the decision to do it.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. And it wasn't actually until 2018 when the Tsleil-Waututh chiefs were fully exonerated.
Wow.
In the eyes of now Canada.
Yeah.
And they are now recognized as heroes.
Cool.
Protecting their land. And so while we're on the topic of law and Bastion Square being the jail in colonizer times, let's take a look into the history of Victoria's police.
Oh.
A little bit.
Oh.
Which began in Bastion Square.
Oh, hot take.
So in 1855, due to a large influx of miners going up north for gold, Governor Douglas requested 10 men be put together.
Okay.
To prevent, quote, interracial conflicts, end quote.
Okay.
Within the settlement, and then, you know, 3 years later, the colonial police were established, later named the BC Provincial Police.
Wow. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. By 1860, the force was led by a man named Francis O'Connor, and it consisted of 12 constables, a night watchman, and one jailer. The police station and barracks during this time were in Bastion Square, where Helmickan Alley is today.
Oh.
Because eventually it gets torn down, and then they put in that alley.
Okay. Okay, I see.
Yeah. The officers were clothed with military-style garb, fit with batons, and once they were given a warrant, they were able to carry a pistol. Because during this time, you had to have a permit.
Right. Makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was kind of interesting. I thought that wouldn't come around until later in life.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, but true. True.
It was like early 1900s that you had to have a full permit even to defend your home.
Wow. Okay. Cool. Yeah.
The barracks themselves had 16 cells. They measured, so half of them were 6 by 12 feet. The other half were 8 by 6.5 feet, and there was one debtors or punisher cell that was used on special occasions.
Oh, so ew.
I think it was solitary confinement.
Okay.
With that said, it wasn't until 1890 when the police force established an official code of conduct.
Hmm.
And on top of that, of course, the justice system during this time was even more problematic.
Yeah.
Punishments were given on an individual basis, unlike following a code kind of like now. And so the same crimes were treated differently with different people.
Wow.
Additionally,
I mean, that still happens today.
Yeah. The time between a crime being committed and a trial was usually 1 or 2 days for minor offenses.
Okay.
So way sped up.
Yeah.
And around 3 weeks for major crimes like murder.
That's very fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The trial processes of this time involved a lot of words and not a lot of writing.
Okay.
So a lot of hearsay going on.
Mm.
It's important to note that there were a lot of people from different ethnicities coming to and going through Victoria, especially during this time with all the gold rushes and everything like that. It was during this time around 1858 when Chinatown had its beginning. So there's a lot of different people going on within a very short amount of time.
Yeah.
Because Fort Victoria was like...
Yeah, it was the main like harbor and trading post. And yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yep, I get it.
And so as you can see, Bastion Square has a lengthy history. And it's almost comedic to think that it's now a pedestrian mall. As quoted from Wikipedia.
Okay, weird.
Well, it is.
Yeah, it is.
You know.
Yeah, yeah.
The historic buildings that are home to the square are the Burns House and Beaver Building, once owned by a hotel man named Thomas Burns, And so the Burns House used to be a luxury hotel right across from the jail, because that makes sense.
Yeah.
Also in this historic area is the Board of Trade Building and the Rithit Building along Wharf Street, in addition to the courthouse, like I mentioned earlier.
Right.
And then, as I said, the Bastion Square became modernized in 1963. And then over time, small shops were situated into the historical buildings, such as Bastion Books, Gage Gallery, Arts Collective, and the restaurant When Cries Mary.
Cool. Oh, I love that one.
Yeah.
It's so good.
And of course, the public market that happens April through October.
Yes. So, but what about the ghosts?
Well, the ghosts are there.
Tell me about the hauntings.
Well, okay, so
okay.
The Burns House was a luxury hotel, and apparently rooms were often rented by the hour by sex workers and clients.
Yep.
And during this time, there was a lot of opium, guys.
Yes.
You know, everybody was doing opium. It was the
so
thing.
So true.
So much was happening. A lot of the clients going into this hotel with these sex workers were politicians. They work in the courthouse steps away. So,
yeah.
You know.
I
and then
see.
They're doing opium, and then they're trying people for crimes.
Right.
And it's said that the spirit of these sex workers still roam the halls of the old hotel looking for new clients.
Okay.
You know, they're just living their life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then most notable spirit of Bastion Square is that of a prisoner from 1850 who was said to be beaten by a guard in the old jailhouse, which, like I said earlier, was partially situated within Helmickin Alley. Many people have seen the apparition of a man from the 1800s wandering through the alley, still wearing the chains he would have been in while he was jailed.
Ooh, spooky.
Okay, there were people hung at the gallows in Bastion Square, right?
Yes.
And apparently, the bodies that didn't get collected by next of kin were just buried on the spot.
Yes,
and
I
so
heard that too.
Apparently, there's bodies under the old courthouse.
Yeah, like a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when other buildings were being built in the area, they did excavate some of that, and they didn't find all of them. I think they found some of them.
Of course.
So
they're like, we'll just leave the rest. It's fine.
Yeah, exactly. So,
yeah.
You know, when there was stuff in the old law courts, now it's empty, but chairs would move, rattle on their own, people would hear whispers, doors closing on by themselves. The whole lot.
Spooky.
You know. If we walk up the square towards Government Street, we'll reach the Garrick's Head Pub, which opened in 1867. And it's said to be the place where many prisoners were granted to have their last meals.
Oh, mm-hmm. Interesting.
It was purchased in 1899 by a man named Mike Powers, who was attacked one day in October when he was opening the saloon.
Like attacked by a ghost?
No. He was struck in the back of the neck with a large bag of sand.
Oh, no.
That split open upon contact.
Oh.
And the police later learned that the attackers were two people, one of which kicked Mike over and over again until they either ran away or someone was like, hey, what are you doing?
Right. Whoa.
And the theory is that these people just hated him.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he later died in Jubilee Hospital. Hmm. It's said that his ghost can be seen sitting by the fireplace in the pub on cold winter nights.
Ooh. Mm.
And lastly, it's said that When Cries Mary is haunted by two spirits, a man named Brady and a woman called Lady Churchill or Charlotte.
Oh.
According to local legend, these two were meant to meet one night when Brady got into a fight and his throat was cut by his assailant.
Oh, my God.
Brady soon died from his injuries, and Charlotte never saw him again. Since then, people have smelt a heavy perfume and cigar smoke in the air when walking past a now restaurant when no one else is around. So I like to believe that these lovers found each other in the afterlife and are enjoying their night out.
Yeah, they're just hanging out at When Cries Mary.
Yeah.
I love
they're
that.
They're just getting a drink. You know.
So good.
And really, that's the history and ghouls of Fashion Square.
You know, there's still a lot of ghouls. Ghoulish stuff happening at Bastion Square.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, just people.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, there's a nightclub in there.
Yes. Yes.
Like, you'd see some crazy stuff in there.
Yeah, it's so true.
Yeah.
Well, I think we have time for one more. So, my story starts at Laurel Point. This area is located in Victoria's downtown harbor, but before Victoria was colonized, this area, much like Sarah's story and from the sources I found, not like Sarah's story, but this area specifically on Laurel Point was used as a burial ground for the Lekwungen peoples mm-hmm. for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of hearsay about what that looked like. I've seen some talk about sky burials, but then I learned that sky burials weren't used by the nations here, so I'm not going to go too much.
What's a sky burial?
Essentially, you leave a body out to be decayed by the natural environment, then you like respectfully and carefully gather the bones and put them into boxes, and mm-hmm. then you put the boxes up into trees.
Oh!
Yeah, like really special trees. But
okay.
I heard that
right.
it doesn't... That. I don't know. Listen.
Look.
The history is really challenging to find.
Yeah,
so,
that's okay.
But we do know that this area was used as a burial ground. So, of course, this land was really sacred and meaningful, and to disrupt this would obviously be a very, very bad choice.
And guess who disrupted it?
An evil settler entrepreneur decided to cut down all the trees on the spot, desecrating the land and those who were resting there. He built a house and a shop.
Not a house?
Yep, a house on the land. But soon after, it all went up in flames without any explanation of why.
Wait, like it just caught on fire by itself?
Yeah, like they don't know where the fire came from. So here's the thing. Here's the even
That's
spookier
intense.
Part.
Okay.
The owner's wife is said to have seen something emerge from the flames during the fire, but it's not clear what she saw. However, she quickly ended up falling ill, and a few weeks later, she died.
Whoa.
The coroner's verdict was that she died of fright.
That is some instant karma.
Yeah.
That's actually crazy. I didn't know that. I don't know this story.
Okay, so then the land is sold to William Pendray, who at the time was one of the largest industrialists in Victoria. Born in Cornwall, England in 1846, William came to BC in 1869 as a gold miner, owning claims across the province. He then shifted to manufacturing soaps, paints, and other varnishes in Victoria by 1875. At some point, he married this woman named Amelia, and they had three sons together. So, by 1890, when he purchased the land, the family is alive and well, and they're now the new owners of a desecrated sacred burial grounds that had been used for time immemorial.
Was the original guy told that, hey...
I think so.
Hey, that's where we bury our dead.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Ew.
And so much like the original guy, William didn't care. He decided to build a factory on the land with the family home nearby. It's about a block away in today's terms.
Actually so crazy because I don't think that these white people would like go to like a white person back in the day, a white person
cemetery. Yeah.
And be like,
they would
build my house here.
No, they I think they would.
You think they would?
I think so, because I think it still happens.
Oh.
Yeah. But anyways.
Okay.
So William didn't care. He decides to build a factory on the land. And within a few years, the first tragedy struck. In 1908, the eldest son, Ernest Pendray, was enjoying a horsey ride into town.
A horse.
So he's on his horsey. He's having a good time.
Clop, clop.
He's not very far from home. When, for some reason, his horse gets super spooked. Did the horse maybe see a ghost?
Yes.
Or perhaps a snake? Because horses are really scared of snakes.
It probably Do we even have snakes here?
Yeah, probably.
It probably saw a ghost.
Garter snakes.
Oh, yeah, but...
I saw one the other day, actually.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Oh.
No one is quite sure, but what happened next feels like it's straight out of a movie. Ernest gets thrown off his horse, flies through the air, and lands on the ground just in time for the wheel of a freight wagon to roll over his head and shoulders, killing him instantly.
Shut up.
Then, a few years later, in 1913, William, the dad, was working away in his factory when a water pipe somehow fell. Probably sketchy engineering because the 1800s of it all, even though it's early 1900s, but like same thing. And the water pipe crushes William's head, killing him instantly.
Ah, what's with the head crushing?
Yeah, I know. So following this, another few years later, the youngest boy of the family dies from pneumonia. It's all pretty tragic, and Amelia was left alone to live in their mansion as the last and only son who survived had grown up and moved out. Amelia stayed in this mansion until May of 1937, when she died in the home from natural causes at 87 years old.
Dang, that's old.
I know. Yeah, she slayed. So the Pendray Mansion has been turned into the Pendray Inn and Tea House, and you can still go there to visit and stay overnight to this day. Many guests have reported experiences while staying at this inn, including having their phones randomly turn on and play music in the middle of the night, and feeling an extremely heavy and uncomfortable presence on the top floor, of the inn. Sinister whispers have been heard in the dining area, which is interesting because why would they be sinister? But
like for, that?
Yeah, exactly like that. I was thinking maybe Amelia's spirit is trying to just like spook people in the afterlife.
Maybe.
Maybe she was a comedian.
A comedian.
And lastly, but most spookily, many guests who have stayed in room number 5, which used to be William and Amelia's main bedroom, will see the apparitions of floating heads thought to be William's and Ernest's.
Ew.
Yeah. Surprisingly, there has been no mention of any hauntings taking place at the Laurel Point Inn, even though it now sits on what has been shared and thought to be the sacred burial grounds. While no one has experienced any paranormal activity, when walking around the property along the path that follows the shore, people who are sensitive often feel a connection to the energy of the dead. For myself, last time I was walking along this pathway, it felt spooky, even though it was broad daylight, and like I was able to sense that there was something more. Perhaps this feeling is the spirits of all those who have lived and died on the land, resting and waiting to welcome those who are next.
Damn.
And that is the story of the Pendray Inn and Tea House. And I think that kind of wraps up our tale for today.
You don't have another one?
Okay.
Jamie has another story.
Okay.
One more story.
One more story.
We got time.
We got a little bit of time, yeah. Our next location is Meakin, which is now known as Beacon Hill Park.
Right. Also burial area, correct?
Yes, which I will get into that in a moment.
Okay.
So Meakin means warmed by the sun in Lekwungen.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, and Lekwungen elder Jimmy Fraser explained that the open meadow in Meakin is where people used to sit to have their bellies warmed in the summer, which is really cute.
So I kind of love that.
I know.
That's cute.
This area was very popular for Lekwungen peoples for hundreds of years as an area to rest, hang out, and play games. Camas and great camas bulbs were cultivated and harvested here as a source of food, and at the base of the main hill was a settlement that was periodically occupied, most likely seasonally, created over 1,000 years ago. Additionally, the hill on Meakin itself is culturally significant as it acted as a burial site for local indigenous groups. Today, you can still find the burial cairns, which are mounds composed of boulders, stones, and dirts, near the top of the southeast slope of the main hill area.
But they were moved and put back, right?
No, So some of them have been moved. Like, there is record of settlers just, like, stealing
the
boulders.
Stone. Yeah.
But some of them are original, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Remember when we were taking your photos there, and then I was like, go over there. And then Montana was like, those are graves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jamie.
I know. I'm sorry. Eventually, during the settlement of the creation of Victoria, James Douglas set Meakin aside and noted it as a protected area in 1858. While it was now a protected area, this was, of course, a colonial effort. The original inhabitants were displaced and dispossessed of their access to Meakin, and thus their sustainable and careful harvesting and caretaking of the land,
mm-hmm.
as it became known as Beacon Hill Park. It was then used by the upper class and wealthy living in the growing city, which means pretty much white people.
Yeah, so they were just like, oh, the indigenous people use this area to hang out. Okay, we're going to do that.
Yes. And Rude. Through time, Beacon Hill has had thousands and thousands of visitors walk its paths with its arms open to all at this point in time, of
yeah.
course. However, you may not want to find yourself walking through Meakin at night. In the winter of 1915, so 110 years ago, a 16-year-old boy had fallen through the ice on Good Acre Lake and drowned.
No.
This is the lake that has the small footbridge over it near Douglas Street. Yeah. Of course,
great.
This was a really tragic event, and it happened more than once. In the same lake, Good Acre Lake, 46 years later, also in winter, another 16-year-old boy named Charles O'Sullivan drowned as well. He was attempting to save his friends who had fallen through the ice,
wow.
but ended up through the ice himself.
That still happens every year, all the time.
Don't go on frozen lakes.
Remember how we used to camp on frozen lakes?
Don't
yes. camp on frozen lakes. It's scary.
It's really scary. When rescuers scrambled to save the teens, Charles went unnoticed until his mom reported him missing a time later, and that night his body was retrieved from the icy waters.
His friends didn't say anything?
They all died? No, they all didn't die, but they were all drowning and like suffering this very traumatic
event.
And I don't think they knew where Charles.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, but that's okay. a good point. I mean, they were probably just traumatized.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
And now, strangely enough, a year before this, before Charles's death in 1950, a 2-year-old boy had drowned in Fountain Lake and was found by a constable for Beacon Hill Park.
Oh, no.
In a strange connection, Charles was the uncle of this 2-year-old boy. He was probably super traumatized by losing his nephew, so when his friends fell in, he wanted to ensure the same fate didn't come upon them. However, he lost his own life instead. Along with these three drownings, many deaths have occurred at Meakin, and it is known to be a beautiful yet eerie park, especially at night.
Wow.
I know.
I didn't know that happened there.
I have another story from Meakin.
Okay.
In the late 1970s, people began witnessing a dark-complexioned woman with long blonde hair standing atop a rock near Douglas Street and the Southgate corner.
Queen.
Do you know this story?
No.
This one is a little intense, so this is my warning for all of you out there listening. This is a bit of a more intense story.
Okay.
She would stand unmoving morning after morning for several months. The people who saw her thought it was strange, but they paid no more attention than that, and eventually she stopped showing up and was soon forgotten. However, 13 years later, in 1983, a woman with a fair complexion and long dark hair, so the opposite of the other woman, was now repeatedly seen standing on the same rock morning after morning. This woman reminded the locals about the previous woman, except for two main differences. First, she had the opposite complexion and hair, and second, the second one was actually a misty apparition, unlike the first. Later that same year, on November 15th, 1983, a body was found in a shallow grave under some bushes near the rock where the woman was seen to be standing. The remains matched the description of the female with the fair skin and dark hair, and they were able to connect it to a missing persons case from June 3rd.
Whoa.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the body of this person was crudely buried from June to November, meters from a walking path and tucked behind the standing rock.
Oh my gosh.
So hundreds of people would have walked by her without knowing.
Oh, that gave me the chills.
I know. Since her body was found, people have spotted the dark-haired woman sitting on the rock where she had been standing previously. It's said that her appearance is usually calm, except that her mouth would hang open, almost as if in a silent scream.
Oh no!
Many people have reported that they have stopped and asked her if she was okay, but she often ignores them. As they walk away and turn to look back, she is either completely vanished or slowly disappears into a mist. The apparition of this woman is thought to be Donna Mitchell, who was the mother of a little girl and who went missing on June 3rd. She was reported by her common-law husband when she didn't make it home for her daughter's 7th birthday. Donna had been spotted downtown having drinks with friends, and the last time she was seen alive was later that evening near the Empress Hotel. Police collected information, but the trail went cold until her body was found on November 15th. The suspect of her murder lived in Vancouver, but was visiting Victoria at the time. Once police found enough evidence to issue a warrant for arrest, they had planned to send two investigators to Vancouver. However, the Vancouver police told them to forget about it, as the suspect had been found dead by hanging. This case is still technically unsolved, but people continue to see Donna's apparition, with many believing that the first woman, the blonde woman with the dark complexion, is the doppelganger of Donna.
Why would she have a doppelganger in spirit form?
I don't know. My theory is maybe the doppelganger was predicting Donna's eventual death and kind of like embodied her spirit.
Creepy.
And prior reports have been made of doppelgangers appearing as a photo negative of the person. I know.
Okay, you just unlocked another fear for me.
Yeah, I know. That's a really, really bummer story. And unfortunately, we will never know. And I hope that one day this case is actually solved and that her daughter and family are able to rest more easily. My heart really goes out to them in this tragedy.
Yeah.
It's now like about 40 years old, but still.
Wow.
If you ever find yourself in Beacon Hill at night, wandering through the confusing forest pathways, stop, look, and listen to see if anyone beyond life is trying to connect with you. You never know what you may come across if you just listen.
Or maybe just don't go into the park at night.
Yeah, don't go into the
park
at night.
Like, you're going to get lost.
Yeah, like,
I always get lost during the day, yeah. And I'm on Google Maps.
I know.
And
it's
a little
confusing. I kind of get it now, but it's still really confusing to me.
I've never even seen the full park.
Really?
Yeah, and I've been here for like 6 years. Night
on Halloween.
Have you gone by the Ross Bay Cemetery lately?
No.
It looks so beautiful in there during fall.
Oh, yes. Okay, true. Yes. I mean, lately-ish, yes.
Oh, I meant during the fall season.
Yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, we hope that everyone has a lovely day today.
Enjoy the market.
Enjoy the market. Get some really cool, beautiful things.
There's so much stuff. We're going to go take a look.
Enjoy everyone's beautiful outfits.
And
you all look amazing.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
And thanks for listening, everybody.
If you have any questions, comments, critiques, or concerns, you can email us at
ghoulsocietypod@gmail.com.
You can follow us on Instagram at
Ghoul Society Pod.
You can follow Sarah's TikTok at
ghoul.societypod.
And you can find all of the resources in each episode's description, along with any trigger warnings as well.
And please, go look us up, leave us a review, subscribe to our YouTube,
comment. Really helps. Tell a friend and get their friends to tell their friends, and we'll create a pyramid scheme.
And if everyone in this room tells a friend,
then
that's a lot of people.
Jinx. Anyway, have a lovely day, and we will see you next time.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.